This is Science Friday. I'm Joe Palka, filling in for Ira Flatow. Rats aren't the most well-loved creatures out there. You've got sewer rats, subway rats, the evil rat in the Nutcracker. Or how about someone calling you a rat? Well, not something most of us aspire to, but this next story might burnish rats' reputations just a little bit. A new study found that rats are actually quite willing to come to another rat's aid, freeing a rat trapped in a container. And they're not just doing it for a dose of sugar water or some other reward, they're doing it out of empathy of the other rat's plight, or so the researchers write in their study out this week in the journal Science. Makes you wonder if empathy really is a uniquely human capacity. Maybe the roots of empathy go back a lot farther than we thought. What do you think? Give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. If you're on Twitter, you can tweet us your questions by writing the at sign followed by SciFry. And if you want more information about what we're talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. And now let me introduce my guest. Peggy Mason is a professor of neurobiology at the University of Chicago. She's the senior author on the rat study, and she joins us from a studio on campus. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Mason.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how did you come to do this research? What was the thinking that made you wonder if rats felt empathy?
We knew that rats feel very or show a very rudimentary form of empathy called emotional contagion. That had been shown, well, it had been shown that rodents show this about 5 years ago by Jeff Mogul at McGill University.
Huh.
And we wanted to take it a step further
What is emotional contagion? I'm sorry, I don't recognize that term.
So emotional contagion is one individual mimicking the emotional state of another individual. And an example of that is when one baby cries, all the babies cry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I got it. Okay. So you took this a step further. Why don't you describe the experimental setup so that we have a sense of what was happening?
Absolutely. So we had an arena, and in the center of the arena was a restrainer. And in the restrainer was one of the rats. And outside of the restrainer, free to roam around, was his cage mate, the free rat. And the restrainer had a door which can only be opened from the outside, so only the free rat can open the door. And when we put the two rats into this situation, the free rat immediately goes to the restrainer, climbs all over the restrainer, bites the restrainer, tries to figure out why his cage mate is stuck in there, and focuses all of his activity on this restrainer. Eventually, these sessions occurred for about an hour a day for 12 days.
Wow.
And by about day six, they figured out how to open the door.
So the rat outside was never shown how to do it, but eventually stumbled on how to open the door for the trapped rat.
Exactly.
Huh.
And it was typically accidental. It's not like the rat can look at the door and say, gee, I see that counterweight.
Yeah.
I know if I push here.
Right.
So it's just because the rat is spending so much time at the restrainer because he's so concerned that he accidentally opens it. And that would be one thing. But the important feature is that the next day he says, oh, okay, I remember the door is the place to be. So he goes right for the door, fiddles with it. Now, instead of taking him 25 minutes to open the door, the next day it takes him 10 minutes. Moreover, when the door falls over, now the free rat expects the sound. The first time it falls over, it makes a sound. The rat freezes because, oh my God, something unusual has happened. I didn't expect that. I'm afraid. But the second time or the third time, certainly by the third time, no longer surprised. So that tells us that by the third time, the rat is intentionally and deliberately opening the door to liberate the trapped cage mate.
Right. And you say empathy. Let's play devil's advocate and say, if you had to challenge your own study, what other explanation could you give for this?
Well, we thought the most simple explanation, when all we had was what I've just told you, we thought the most simple explanation was simply that the free rat wanted to play with the trapped rat. That seems like a straightforward reason to open the door. And so we were very worried about that, or concerned that that might be the case. So what we did was we put two arenas together. And then instead of putting the restrainer in the middle of one arena, we put the restrainer right up against the divide. Mm-hmm. And the door was at the divide. Now the free rat, when he opened the door, the trapped rat was liberated, but only into an adjacent arena, and they were not allowed, they couldn't play together. And we did this for almost 30 days, and day after day, the free rat would open the door to liberate the trapped cagemate, even though they never got to play.
Right. Okay. And the other explanation that occurred to me, and I heard Nell Greenfield Boyce's story on NPR this morning. She played this ultrasonic sound that the rats, I don't think it was the right frequency, but I mean, she played it at a frequency we could hear. But
that's right.
But the rats hear this. I mean, isn't it like, you know, shut that bloody racket up and I'll let you out so that you'll stop making that screeching noise?
It's an entirely reasonable concern. The reason we don't think that that's what's going on is that we only recorded ultrasonic vocalizations in 13% of the sessions. So it was very unusual. And certainly rats would open the door in sessions where there were no alarm calls.
Okay. Well, empathy, that certainly is something that people would tend to believe. But let's see what our callers think. Let's go to Logan in Moultrie, Georgia. Logan, welcome to Science Friday. You're on the air.
Great. Good afternoon. Real quick, I was just thinking about a YouTube video that I saw of a dog, I believe it was in Colombia, coming to the rescue of another dog that had been hit by a car on the interstate. And that sure seemed like empathy to me.
Well, let's see what Dr. Mason.
I agree with you. I think that the reality is that there are lots of anecdotes. And we see empathy in our pets all the time. But these anecdotes are probably have a large kernel of truth to them, and yet they don't allow us to understand anything more about empathy. And this is the first time that we've really controlled a situation, and we can prove that this is empathic helping behavior. And moreover, now we can use this model to examine what are the neurological, behavioral, genetic, pharmacological mechanisms that give rise to helping behavior.
Hey, Logan, thanks for the call.
You're certainly welcome.
Appreciate it. So what other emotional states do you think rats might be capable of? I mean, emotional senses that sort of mimic things that we tend to think of mostly as human.
Well, I think they certainly show fear.
Well, I would think that most animals, I mean, fear seems pretty widespread.
Fear is very useful. But the empathy is probably derived from the maternal relationship to her offspring. And it's very important for a mother to know how her babies feel, particularly if that mother is a mammal. Mm-hmm. In the case of mammals, the babies get born and they're basically helpless.
Yeah.
And so if mom doesn't know when the baby is hungry or cold or in some way distressed, then the baby is less likely to grow, develop, survive, and thrive.
Interesting. Let's take another call from Max, who's in your same city of Chicago, Illinois. Max, welcome to Science Friday. You're on the air.
Hello. She just actually touched on my point, which was that, you know, I've studied evolutionary psychology and behavioral genetics, and it seems to me that any creature that cares for its offspring is capable of empathy. Anything that has a limbic system has to, like as you said, be sensitive to the needs of their offspring, and you know, its fears, its wants, its desires, and its needs. So, I mean, is there any way that you're differentiating this sort of rat empathy from, basic maternal or parenting empathy?
Well, yes, these are unrelated male adults. And so the idea is that although empathic helping may have started with the mother-offspring relationship, it has generalized to relationships that go beyond that, to relationships between two adults, between two unrelated individuals, and so on. And I think that the potential benefit of this generalization is that social groups are more cohesive if the members of those social groups are willing to help each other, are sensitive to each other's distress and willing to help.
And you had a condition in the experiment where you tried to get at this, you know, where the animal had a choice between something tasty and being helpful. Maybe you
could describe that.
So
we really wanted to understand what the value of helping behavior was to the rat. So we did what we called in the lab the chocolate versus pal experiment. And this was one arena, two restrainers. In one restrainer was five chocolate chips, and in the other restrainer was the trapped cage mate. Now, these rats had been eating chocolate for weeks, and they ate, on average, more than seven chocolate chips. When they get, when the free rat is placed into this arena, we didn't know what would happen. But what did happen was that the free rat opened both restrainers in no consistent order. So on one day, he might open the chocolate restrainer first, and on another day, he might open the trapped cage mate restrainer first. So the result was that there was no difference in the opening times for the restrainers of the two types. And what this told us was that liberating a trapped cage mate is on a par with very yummy chocolate, which was really quite striking. But even more amazing, and this was the thing that shocked me the most in the entire study, is that the free rat, although there were multiple ways that he could hog all the chocolate chips, he did not. He shared, on average, one and a half chocolate chips with the liberated cage mate.
Well, all I can say is I wouldn't try that experiment on humans, because I'm sure they'd leave me trapped. Most of my colleagues would leave me trapped and go for the chocolate and then let me out. But anyway, it's an interesting set of experiments. Thanks for sharing them with us today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Peggy Mason is a professor of neurobiology at the University of Chicago. After the break, we'll be talking about Asia's space race and whether this competition between China, Japan, and India could lead to war in space. Stay with us.
Since the climate negotiations are proving difficult, some climate strategists have been hard at work searching for solutions outside of the United Nations. One involves preserving forests as carbon storehouses. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
The idea has been floating around for years. Rich countries that emit lots of climate-warming gases could just pay poorer countries to keep their forests, or even grow them bigger. Forests suck carbon out of the atmosphere. It's like paying someone to put carbon in a storehouse, and it would be cheaper than retrofitting factories and power plants at home. This is called RED for short, Reduced Emissions from Deforestation and Forest Degradation. Hans Bresker, Foreign Minister of Norway, thinks it's a great idea, and not just a slow warming.
We very strongly believe that we will have established a genuine global partnership to save the remaining tropical forest.
Norway is spending about $3 billion to make RED happen. But skeptics question whether forest storehouses are safe. What's to stop people from cutting them down someday and releasing all that carbon back into the atmosphere? What about indigenous people who live in forests? Will they lose their forest homes if the woods are turned into carbon plantations? At the South African climate talks, skeptics sometimes mocked the idea of RED, such as when Simone Lovera from the Global Forest Coalition announced the Muddled Moose Award.
Welcome very, very much for this media event to announce the winner of the Muddled Moose Award, to alert people of the big fairy tales that are being told about RED.
But RED's backers say it offers something for rich and poor countries alike, and some are not waiting for the United Nations to decide on a final RED process.
International action would be great, but we're not seeing it. We're not seeing it anywhere.
Tony Brunello is a forestry expert with the RED Offset Working Group in the U.S. Brunello wants California, where he once advised the governor on climate issues, to partner with states in other countries on RED projects. Even though the U.S. does not limit greenhouse gases, California will, starting in 2013.
The fundamental issue is to give a signal to the rest of the world that it's possible, and also a stamp of approval from California, and that people should invest in it.
California businesses will need to buy so-called carbon offsets, projects where someone, somewhere, removes carbon from the atmosphere, because that's cheaper than doing it themselves. Brunello's group will match those businesses with states like Acre in Brazil and Chiapas in Mexico. Those places have lots of forests they can preserve for a price. But so far, there are no rules for this.
How does a company in California, a Pacific Gas and Electric, a Southern California Edison, how would they legally go and talk with the people in Acre and Brazil and do a carbon offset trade?
California officials are open to the idea, but cautious. Mary Nichols runs the state's climate program at the Air Resources Board.
We don't have the resources ourselves to, you know, to take over the forest management of those parts of the world.
And carbon banks will need to be managed. For example, you'll need to measure exactly how much carbon is stored in a forest, because companies will be paying for it by the ton. Then how do you safeguard your investment? The Amazon, for example, is a carpet of green about two-thirds the size of the continental U.S. Environmental scientist Greg Asner at Stanford University thinks he's got a solution with something called LIDAR, a special laser carried on an airplane.
And that laser is able to pick up the three-dimensional structure of the canopy all the way down to the ground and all the layers in between from the top down to the bottom. It's like a virtual world. You can find the species you're interested in. You can understand its carbon. You can understand how tall the trees are, how many branches they have.
Asner has flown his device over some of the most remote parts of the Amazon. He says he can tell how healthy a forest is, how diverse, and even what kind of animals live there. The Offset Working Group is crafting rules and technical specs for red projects. Acre and Chiapas have already passed measures to pave the way there. The team figures if it works for California, they can take it on the road, with or without an international treaty. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Diplomats at the United Nations climate talks in Durban, South Africa, are still struggling to bring that meeting to some sort of close. Still no deal from the talks, which are supposed to coordinate international efforts on global warming. Diplomats are hoping that all the talk won't prove to be just a lot of carbon emissions. We're joined now from the talks by NPR's Richard Harris. Richard, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Scott.
Durban's a beautiful place to be. And saying goodbye is a hard thing for all of us. But what's holding up the talks?
Good question. Well, I'm in the basement of the conference center, so it's not quite as beautiful down here. But in the biggest sense, this has never been an easy topic, because climate change really touches on some of the biggest and most difficult issues out there. Developing nations put their economic growth first, which is understandable. Rich nations are worried about economic competitiveness. And, of course, are the oil-rich nations, which worry about their future economies. And let's not forget the island nations, who worry about disappearing under the waves as sea level rises. So that's the big picture. More specifically, here in Durban, the biggest disagreement is really what to do during the coming decade in order to ramp up efforts on climate change.
Wasn't there a deal just 2 years ago in Copenhagen?
There was, and it was a voluntary agreement. It had some very strong language, and the really good news about that is it brought all the world's biggest emitters together, the United States and China, and they've all pledged to take steps to slow their carbon emissions, so that's good. The bad news is that those pledges don't add up enough to prevent the planet from heating up quite rapidly. So there's been a lot of pressure at this meeting to find a way to step up the ambition and speed things up, and really a lot of disagreement about what that different deal should look like.
What are the prospects as you see it for some kind of compromise?
It's hard to say right now. I just came from upstairs where ministers are huddled in a meeting trying to work something out. What they are really working on is language that's loose enough and ambiguous enough to satisfy everyone, particularly countries like the United States, China, and India, who are still thinking about those big pledges they made in Copenhagen and saying, you know, can we actually do more than that? And they are, on the other hand, the weaker the language gets, if you make, you know, the lowest common denominator kind of language, then draws objections from more ambitious branches of folks here, including the European Union and, of course, many of the world's poorest countries.
Yeah. And, of course, we've been hearing that this is all tied up with the future of the Kyoto Climate Treaty. How does that play into events?
Well, let me remind you, the Kyoto Treaty now only pertains to Europe and a handful of other countries, and be it their initial promises to reduce emissions actually sunset at the end of next year. So the treaty really has no long-term future. It does not include the world's biggest emitters, us and China and India and so on. But the developing world still loves it because it explicitly says that they don't have to take any action to combat climate change unless the rich nations pay them to do so. So Europe is still willing to extend its commitment under the Kyoto Treaty, but they're trying to use that as leverage, essentially, to bring about a new deal here that includes everybody. I'm not sure if the ambiguous lingual language we've been hearing about is enough to satisfy Europe's position about that, and they have very ambitious goals of their own for trying to reduce climate change. They want to get everyone else on board on there. So really what we're seeing here in part is the fate of the Kyoto Treaty is hanging in the balance.
And Richard, what happens if there's no agreement?
Well, in the short run, that would be an embarrassment for the host country. The Kyoto Protocol in particular is loved on this continent, and South Africans don't want to have it die on African soil. Mm-hmm. And other people don't want to put them in that position either. So that's there. It's possible the conference will adopt some important but more technical decisions, and it's also possible that a lot of this will just get kicked down the road for 6 months or a year until the next meeting.
Well, and we hope you'll be there. NPR's Richard Harris at the UN Climate Talks in Durban. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.